Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker in London.
And in Washington, D.C., I'm Jackie Day. Welcome to the podcast.
And welcome back to you, Jackie. Very nice to have you at the microphone again.
Thanks, Chuck.
In this week's tour of the global risk landscape, we'll discuss the outlook for South Africa, where the dramatic shakeup of President Jacob Zuma's cabinet, including the sacking of his finance minister, has led to a credit downgrade and sent the rand, the national currency, plunging to its lowest level since 2015.
Then we'll turn to Venezuela, where a power grab by the pro-regime Supreme Court last week represents the most serious move yet towards a full democratic rupture and open dictatorship in the country. Although the court revoked its takeover of the opposition-led Congress in response to protests and international condemnation, the action points to further political and economic uncertainty ahead for the oil-rich nation.
But first, Turkey. Checks and balances are in question there as well. On Sunday, the 16th of April, Turkish voters will decide on 18 proposals to the Constitution that would further concentrate power into the hands of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The proposed change is controversial, and the period before and after the vote will be susceptible to social unrest as well as potential terrorist attack. David Lee is our senior analyst for Western Europe and Turkey, and I spoke with him about the upcoming referendum. David, bring us up to speed before we get into the details on what this moment coming up in Turkey is all about.
So on the 16th of April, the Turkish electorate votes in the referendum on changing the constitution. The new draft constitution changes Turkey's system of governance from the parliamentary system that it's been throughout its modern history to an executive presidency more along the lines of the one seen in France, say. This is a pet project of the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who wants to transition the country to this presidential system of government, feels it's more effective. And as a result, the referendum is very much a vote of confidence or otherwise in his own personality.
So, Dave, you were in Turkey not too long ago.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of coverage of this issue from a Western point of view. But what did you learn when you were on the ground in Turkey? And what do you think the outcome is going to be?
Well, the first thing I learned is how uneven the campaign is in terms of billboards and media and other publicity. On the drive in from Istanbul Airport to the city, you pass, 10 or 15 major office blocks or construction projects which are shrouded in vote yes banners with Erdogan's face on them. And if you want to see a no banner, you have to crane your neck quite effectively to be able to see one on the side of the road. And that's mirrored in newspaper adverts, TV coverage, both paid for and in news media. So, it's very much a one-sided contest from that point of view. On the ground in Istanbul and to a lesser extent in other cities, there's a lot of no stickers and handbills and, graffiti. That does suggest that there is quite a substantial opposition movement as well. We reckon it will be a clear yes vote in the end, but not exactly a crushing one.
Okay, Dave. So back to the predictions. What's the outlook for business if it goes yes or if it goes no?
I think the key thing here is a short-term, long-term difference. I think if it's a no in the short term, that's probably worse for business in the next few months. I think a no is probably more likely to provoke more social unrest. It'll underline the division in the country. I think terrorist actors who've been relatively quiet in these last few months, I suspect they'll reaccelerate their activity, probably more in the case of no. There'll be protests in the streets. I think they'll be mostly suppressed. But Erdogan is not going to give up. This is his goal, particularly with the centenary of the founding of the state of modern Turkey coming up in 2023. He wants this. He's not going to give it up. He's going to try and find another way to do it. I suspect we may get elections again to try and cash in on his popularity at the moment. So I don't think a no vote necessarily stabilizes the situation in the short term. In the long term, different matter. In the long term, a yes vote removes so many of the checks and balances against excessive executive power, because this new constitution is designed to focus power in the shape, in the person of Erdogan himself. So I think the yes vote is probably more of a threat to business in the long term, because the legislative process will become more personalized and will become more closely identified with everyone's own views. And I also think in the short term, the security implications of a yes vote are probably going to be rather less. That's the key message I'd like to get over here, the short-term, long-term difference.
Dave, if that's the key difference, how does this position Turkey in the long term? And take us into a future where the referendum has already faded from memory and the country changes. And remind us, if you will, how much longer we have Erdogan in office, whether it's as a strong president or not.
I think a post-Erdogan situation is something that we've got to give quite a bit of consideration to as we look into this referendum. Yes, the new constitution would concentrate the power in him, but what happens if and when he goes? There doesn't appear to be anybody else within the governing AKP or anywhere else with the strength of will and strength of personality to carry this kind of a system off. So I'm not sure in the long term that a presidential system so bound up in one person is a really good idea. Slightly shorter term, I think we'll see movements in relation to Europe. Erdogan said quite clearly that he wants to renegotiate the relationship with the EU after the referendum. He'll probably do that if it's a yes or a no, to be honest. So I think there are some pretty fundamental changes coming after the referendum, mostly if it's a yes, but quite a few if it's a no as well.
And Dave, just one more thing. Remind us exactly how much longer Erdogan has to serve in his term of office.
So Erdogan faces an election in 2019, having been elected in 2014. If he wins the executive presidency, obviously the clock starts again, not term limited, so he can carry on way into the late 2020s.
Right, okay, well, I'm sure between now and then we'll be back to talk about this more than once. David Lee, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Jackie, now let's turn to Venezuela. We've been following the economic and political crisis there for some time now. Things are certainly not improving. What's the latest?
Sure, Chuck. Well, at the end of March, the Supreme Court, which is controlled by the ruling Chavista party of President Nicolas Maduro, granted itself the ability to take over the legislative responsibilities of Congress. The court also called into question the parliamentary immunity that protects opposition lawmakers from criminal prosecution. In other words, the ruling party made clear moves to seize total control of the government. In doing so, Maduro's regime stands to become the first Latin American dictatorship to emerge in the 21st century. I spoke with Raul Gallegos, our lead analyst for the Andean region, and author of the book Crude Nation, How Oil Riches Ruined Venezuela. Raul, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for the invite.
So, Raul, is Venezuela now a dictatorship? And why are Venezuelans not rebelling more strongly against a regime that has delivered economic implosion, food shortages, and the highest inflation on earth?
Well, that's a good question. Venezuela is pretty much becoming an open dictatorship now. What we had seen in the past was a Chavismo movement that during the last 17, 18 years appeared to follow the forms of democracy, but at the same time took the steps needed to have absolute control over all the branches of government and exercise a level of control that only autocracies typically possess without actually being branded a dictatorship. It seems, though, that since they decided to scrap the recall referendum against the president and they decided to delay regional and gubernatorial elections that were due last year, and now we're seeing a government that has absolutely no qualms about using the Supreme Court to continue to nullify Congress, a democratically elected Congress, I may add, then certainly what we're seeing is a regime that is comfortable in moving in the direction of becoming an open autocracy. Now, why haven't Venezuelans rebelled in a sort of more violent way is certainly something that is important to look at. Venezuelans might have a society where you have a lot of criminal violence going on, but the idea of killing presidents or major political assassinations has not been something that has occurred in Venezuela's modern history the last 100 years. They had a major uprising called El Caracazo in 89, where 300 people died. That event became ingrained in the historical memory of people, and they don't want to repeat that. And so that is actually a positive in the sense that you don't see people killing each other over the current political situation, but also means that a cynical government that has no qualms about violating basic rules of democracy can feel comfortable that it is very unlikely that people will get organized and angry enough and ready to sacrifice their lives to get rid of that regime in a non-democratic way, if you will.
Interesting. So then with that, what is the likelihood, if any, of regime change in the next 2 years?
Well, in our view, it's low. The Chavista regime has taken the right steps under Maduro to cement its power. They control all the levers of power. That means the Supreme Court. That means the Attorney General's office. They control the military, and they control all the economic levers of power as well. So they have been able to neutralize Congress, which is the only institution that is controlled by the opposition. And in that sense, it seems as though it's very difficult to get rid of this regime through both democratic and non-democratic means. It seems the military will continue to back Chavismo. And as long as the military continues to support Maduro and the regime, it will be very hard for the opposition to try and unseat this government just through street protests and other types of demonstrations. I mean, this government is not in any way threatened so that the president needs to resign.
With that context, then, how can companies operate successfully in Venezuela today, and what should the private sector expect going forward?
Well, in Venezuela, obviously, a number of unfriendly economic policies remain in place. I mean, in 2003, the government imposed capital controls and imposed price controls, and that has made it very difficult for companies producing in Venezuela to continue to do so profitably. The big problem is the government doesn't have the foreign currency. The private sector needs to import raw material or finished products, and then when they do, price controls force them to sell products at below cost and they lose money. The government has used these policies to control the private sector, to punish companies that do not support the government and reward companies that are friendly to the government with access to foreign currency, for instance. So given that these economic tools are now part of the way that Chavismo controls society, they are very unlikely to go away. So these are going to be challenges that the private sector is going to have to be facing.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your expert insights with us today.
Thank you for the invite.
Jackie, thanks. We'll continue to monitor the situation in Venezuela very closely. Switching gears, let's discuss another current hotspot for political risk, South Africa. Some are calling for the resignation of President Jacob Zuma following a cabinet reshuffle that resulted in the downgrade of South African credit to junk status and has sent investors reeling. Seamus Duggan is one of our analysts covering the crisis. He called me earlier from Johannesburg. Seamus, very quickly at the outset, please bring us up to speed on just what's happened most recently in South Africa, in the capital, Pretoria.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. So essentially what's happened is on the 30th of March, President Zuma removed the finance minister, Pravin Gordhan, and his deputy, Msibisi Jonas, in a wide-ranging cabinet reshuffle that evoked very public splits within the ANC, with a number of sort of anti-Zuma figures and leaders in the party publicly criticizing Zuma's decision to essentially unilaterally reshuffle his cabinet. Since then, a number of these figures have backtracked on their public criticisms and have started to close ranks around Zuma ahead of a scheduled no-confidence vote brought by the opposition that will be heard in Parliament on the 18th of April. Meanwhile, the 7th of April, we're seeing a number of protests organized by civil society, opposition groups, and even some labor movements taking place across major urban centers in South Africa, with the focal points really being in the Johannesburg Central Business District, in the Pretoria sort of Central Business District, as well as in Cape Town and Durban.
So Seamus, then bring us into the moment, if you can. What does this mean for South Africa? Why is this such an important coming together today?
Looking sort of at the broader context, the past week is really a key moment in terms of the ANC's succession battle as the party moves towards its December elective conference, where it's going to pick not only its next party president to follow Jacob Zuma, but also in all likelihood the next president of South Africa following the 2019 general elections. And we've seen factions simmering within the party for much of the last sort of 12, 18, 24 months. Gordhan, the former finance minister, was seen very much as a leader of an anti-Zuma faction within the ANC. And by removing Gordhan, Zuma has essentially called out his critics and said, well, I've taken your leader, one of your leaders, sort of out of the way. What are you going to do about it, essentially? And for the moment, and for the next week, for the next 2 weeks, perhaps, how these successions or dynamics play out are going to remain very much in flux as we watch the senior anti-Zuma leaders within the party and how they're going to react. At the moment, the dynamics appear to be favoring Zuma.
Seamus, Zuma's not just facing opposition from within his own party, though. There's a motion of no confidence brought by the opposition. What's the current disposition of that move?
Yeah, so essentially two opposition parties, the Democratic Alliance and the Economic Freedom Fighters, both brought motions of no confidence against the president. These have now been consolidated into one motion of no confidence, which will be debated by Parliament on the 18th of April. It is highly unlikely that this motion of no confidence in the president will succeed. The ANC continues to control 249 of Parliament's 400 seats. It has a history of sort of voting down these no confidence votes, even when they are internal divisions. The party prefers to deal with these sorts of problems internally and would be loath to be seen to be bending to the will of an opposition party. I think in all likelihood what we will see at this vote of no confidence is some ANC MPs possibly abstaining or not pitching up to Parliament on the day. And we may see one or two voting in favour of the motion. However, at the moment, even the senior anti-Zuma leadership within the party are closing ranks and calling for the ANC MPs to reject this motion of no confidence.
Seamus, we've always known that Zuma has been a controversial figure within his own party and broadly across South African politics. It looks like we're in for at least some sort of change in the coming weeks and months. What's the business community doing in the midst of this transition period, in the midst of this uncertainty? What does all of this mean for business?
Also, at the highest level, what it means in terms of foreign investment is it's going to be damaging to investor sentiment, and it's going to cause sort of a depreciation of attitudes towards the South African local economy. This was probably illustrated best in the decision by ratings agency Standard & Poor's to downgrade South Africa to sub-investment or junk status. For the moment, that's most likely to impact government's ability to finance infrastructure projects, etc. Because of this, we expect that the cost will be passed along to borrowers. More generally, we're also going to see increased currency volatility in the short term, rising inflation, and in the longer term, more increases in interest rates. Beyond that, the continued instability within the ANC and the continued infighting and the lack of direction is going to aggravate policy uncertainty. In the longer term, if, as we expect, Zuma perhaps has consolidated his control over the party, it's entirely likely that we'll see a sort of a gradual shift towards increasingly populist policies as Zuma tries to mobilize support both for himself and for the party ahead of the 2019 general elections.
Great. Seamus Duggan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chuck, thanks. Before we sign off, here's a look at a few other issues we'll be watching in the coming weeks. On Monday, April 17th, rallies are likely across Brazil. Activist groups led by the Landless Workers Movement will be commemorating the killing by police of 19 demonstrators in 1996. Businesses should be aware of possible disruption as a result.
On Wednesday, the 19th of April, the Indonesian capital of Jakarta holds its closely contested election for governor. Political and security tensions will be heightened as polling day approaches. Localized clashes between rival supporters are likely, but should not result in mass violence.
And on Sunday, April 23rd, France will hold the first round of its presidential election. The race to succeed François Hollande is tight. Marine Le Pen of the far-right National Front has a consistent but narrow lead in the polls and is likely to proceed to the runoff. Some social unrest is likely at election-related rallies, but major disturbances are unlikely.
Jackie, I've got to tell you, that's one that we're all watching over here in Europe very, very closely. That's it for the early April edition of the Risk Map podcast. Jackie, thanks again for joining me and for sitting in as co-host.
Thanks for having me, Chuck.
And thanks to you, our listeners. Join us every 2 weeks via Podbean, iTunes, and the Control Risks website. For more analysis of risk and opportunity in 2017, visit riskmap.controlrisks.com. Bye for now from London.
And from Washington, D.C., thanks for tuning in.